Because the price of coal is sweat and blood. A miner fears no man, and every day he faces death, a shovel in his hand. How many men could face the fact a miner has to face? The hole he digs might have to be his final resting place. Here's my song for the miner, Canadian miner, let me tell.
Company was bringing strike breakers from Britain, all the way from Britain, and they was bringing blacks from the United States.
Beginning in the 1870s, the coal miners of Vancouver Island in Canada had fought strike after strike to force the hard-nosed coal barons to recognize a union. Thanks to strike breakers, blacklists, anti-union courts, and the forces of so-called law and order, they lost them all. Finally, in 1911, the miners invited in the tough, experienced, and deep-pocketed United Mine Workers of America to make one last all-out attempt. What started as a flare-up over safety quickly sparked into a conflict that was the most protracted, violent, and hard-fought strike in British Columbia's long labor history, lasting 2 years from 1912 to 1914. Today, from the On the Line podcast, we bring you the story of the Vancouver Island coal strike.
The skyscraper became the site of protest, an architecture of oppression and also opportunity.
What are the social and political dimensions of industrial innovation and technological change? In the 1880s and 1890s, architectural historian Joanna Merwood Salisbury argues the skyscraper was the subject of an ideological battle as both a symbol of capitalism's triumph and the target of anti-capitalist protest. As metal replaced masonry in tall building construction, traditional building trades such as bricklayers and carpenters lost their power, and new trades including ironworkers gained importance. General contractors, architects, and engineers organized into professional groups to manage the complexity of industrialized construction. Tall buildings they designed and erected were occupied by new kinds of urban workers, not only office employees, but also immigrant laborers engaged in manufacturing. In part one of her online talk for the Skyscraper Museum last November, Merwood Salisbury traces labor protests in the construction industry in Chicago in the 1880s and examines the formation of unions uniting trades-based groups with ethnic organizations, as well as the public spaces of their protest movements. And on labor history in two,
the Industrial Revolution had created a new set of social conditions, those of high unemployment and slum housing, crime, and infant mortality.
Rick Smith tells us about the rise of the settlement houses. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
Here's my song for the miner, Canadian miner. 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 Here's my song for the miner.
Welcome to another edition of On the Line, a podcast that aims to bring British Columbia's rich labor heritage to life. I'm your host, Rod Mickleborough. We touched on the Great Vancouver Island Coal Strike in our very first podcast, It featured Joe Naylor, the legendary labor leader from Cumberland, who was in the forefront of that long, bitter strike. Now, we are taking a closer look at a conflict that was one of the most protracted, violent, and hard-fought strikes in BC's long labor history. The Vancouver Island coal strike took place more than 100 years ago. It lasted 2 years, from 1912 to 1914. Those who took part never forgot it. Thanks to interviews conducted by oral historian Howie Smith in 1975, when veterans of the strike were still alive, you will hear some of their stories in their own words. And not just the men, you will hear from women too. None were more powerful than what the legendary Mother Jones, known far and wide as the Miner's Angel, wrote in her autobiography about the plight of the Vancouver Island coal miners after visiting them in 1914.
Men's hearts are cold. They're indifferent. Not all the coal that is dug warms the world. It remains indifferent to the lives of those who risk their life and health down in the blackness of the earth, who crawl through dark, choking crevices with only a bit of lamp on their caps to light their silent way, whose backs are bent with toil, whose very bones ache, whose happiness is sleep, and whose peace is death.
From the 1870s on, miners had fought strike after strike to force the hard-nosed coal barons to recognize a union. Thanks to strikebreakers, blacklists, anti-union courts, and the forces of so-called law and order, they lost them all. Finally, in 1911, the miners invited in the tough, experienced, and deep-pocketed United Mine Workers of America to make one last all-out attempt to bring the mine owners to heel. The strike began as a flare-up over safety. The mines were terrible places to work, dark and dangerous. Deadly mine explosions, usually the result of gas buildup, were far too common. The death toll was heartbreaking.
You don't forget. When you see 30 graves all dug in a row waiting to be filled with the men you've known all your life, wouldn't you fight and starve if need be? If when your man left the house, you didn't know how he was coming back?
The conditions in the mine wasn't too good. Even it was all open lights.
It was open lamps. Just the little teapot, fish oil lamps they used.
An open flame?
Yeah. You went into your place, you held your lamp halfway between the roof and the floor. If you put it down, it went out in black damp. That's a heavier than air gas. And if you put it up, you lit the gas, the explosive gas, on fire.
Yes, there was gas. Before maybe 1901, I think there was 60-odd killed. Number 6 mine at the right alongside of the village office there.
When that explosion took place in number 6, it was a month before they got anyone out. There wasn't a soul. It took them a month. They had to flood the mine to get the bodies. Every man was killed in it.
So,
number 6 mine.
And it was that kind of condition that the men were objecting to?
It was building up again in all 4 mines, see? And at the time of the strike, it was still open lamps.
By 1912, after hundreds of coal miner deaths, the government had bowed to pressure. Miners appointed by the workers were now allowed to inspect the mines and report possible dangers. Except when Oscar Modishaw and Isaac Portry reported finding gas in the number 2 mine at Extension near Nanaimo, Modishaw was fired. He managed to find a new job in Cumberland, but when management learned his history, he was fired again. On September 16th, 1912, miners protested the company's action by staying home on what they called a one-day holiday. Ellen Bowater, later Ellen Greenwell, was 19 and living in Extension at the time.
They could tell men to do a thing, like report that gas, and the minute they reported it, they were fired. Well, that was enough to show me just then that there was something wrong. There must be something wrong when a committee's hired to report something, and when they report it, they fire these men. There must be something wrong with the boss's side, mustn't there?
The day after the miners' one-day protest, the mine owners locked them out. Within days, 1,600 miners in Extension, Ladysmith, and Cumberland were off the job. The war was on. This was no longer about Oscar Modishaw. This was a bruising, no-holds-barred, bare-knuckled fight to force the mine owners to recognize the United Mine Workers as the miners' union of choice. The notorious James Dunsmuir had sold his family's mines 2 years earlier, but the new owners were every bit as ruthless. Right off the bat, they evicted the striking miners from their company-owned homes, forcing them into tents or anywhere else they could find a place to sleep.
We moved on to what they call Strikers Beach and lived in tents the first winter. We got enough lumber to put a floor in and a 3-foot wall. The kitchen stove, it was sitting out on an old road next to main highway, and we built a lean-to over it. And that's where we cooked all winter, and dug a well, and a lot more. We weren't the only ones. But the next spring, things didn't look good, so we got a little more lumber and built a place for us to live, and we stayed there, and the other ones, too, stayed there.
Some single men took to living in boathouses.
Batching in a boathouse in the middle of Comox Lake. Batching in a boathouse with nothing but hard beefsteak. When the keg of Pilsner beer was a bachelor's only cheer. Oh, it's lovely batching in a boathouse. There was batchers batched in floating boathouses out here.
At the same time, the mine owners threw all their energy into keeping the mines running. That meant strike breakers. Vulnerable Chinese and Japanese miners were threatened with eviction and deportation if they did not keep working. Strike breakers were also brought in from beyond Canada's borders. Many didn't realize a strike was on, but they were guarded by government and private security forces. Tensions ran high.
The company was bringing strike breakers from Britain.
All the way from Britain?
All the way from Britain. And they were bringing blacks from the United States.
And did the strikers, the striking miners, ever confront these strike breakers when they came in?
Oh, sure.
You couldn't stop them.
No, they had thugs from the States with pistols stuck on their side here, you know.
The company had their own police. They hired them. And then there's a provincial police, see? Later on, 1913, they brought around 500 soldiers from the 72nd Battalion in Victoria. Brought them up.
The miners greeted the soldiers sent in by Attorney General William Bowser with derision and song.
Oh, did you see the kilties, boys? The laugh would nearly kill you, boys. The day they came to kill both great and small, with bayonet, shot, and shell, to blow you all to hell, did Bowser and his gallant 72.
Then hurrah, boys, hurrah, for the Bowser 72. It's the handy, candy, dandy 72. Will make the world look small, run on by Colonel Hall and Bowser with his gallant 72.
They stood some curious shapes, these boys. They must have sprung from apes, these boys, dressed up in kilts to represent the law. My conscience, it was grand. Hurrah for old Scotland and Bowser with his gallant 72.
Then hurrah, boys, hurrah for Bowser 72. It's the handy, candy, dandy 72. 'Twill make the world look small, run on by Colonel Hall and Bowser with his gallant 72.
They could not stand at ease, me boys. They had no strength, believe me, boys. Some had to stand upon their guns or fall. And many a mother's son had never seen a gun, but mind you, they were Bowser 72.
Then hurrah, boys, hurrah, for
they marched 1,000 men from Nanaimo, from Victoria to Nanaimo. And they split the battalion in Nanaimo. 500 stayed in Nanaimo, and they brought 500 up here. Closed the schools, put us kids out of school on the streets, and put the machine gun up in the yard.
They had machine guns here?
Oh, yeah.
Machine guns at the post office, yeah. And up at the village office, and in the schoolyard.
That was Bowser's government.
So they had machine guns at the post office, does that mean that every time you went to mail a letter, there were soldiers?
Oh,
there?
No, they didn't bother, but you didn't stick around.
And if they saw two or three standing talking, they'd go, come on, get on the main street here. Oh, yes. Yeah.
That must have made things pretty tense in town here.
Yeah, but still, old Joe never held up people who held the boys down.
There wasn't too much violence then.
There was no violence.
Not in here, but in the
only till they had that kind of a riot when that engineer come down the main street with the old graphophone horn, hollering, come on, boys, get into it while the water's boiling.
Several months after the union expanded the strike to all mines on the island, the frustration of watching strikebreakers going to work day after day to keep the mines operating became too much. Union tempers exploded on the night of August 13th, 1913. In Ladysmith, Chinatown was ransacked. Homes of strikebreakers and mine supervisors burned to the ground. Tensions ran even higher in Extension, where scabs liked to taunt the strikers. Some were armed. There were fears they were going to use guns to drive the strikers from their camp. They rushed to the mine to head off an attack. Ellen Greenwell remembers what happened next.
They must have had their guns loaded. Oh, yes. One guy here by the name of Baxter got shot right in the arm. I was lucky. I was running right back up the hill, but I didn't get shot.
Rumors spread quickly that six strikers had been shot and killed. Although the rumor was untrue, large crowds of furious miners headed to Extension. Homes owned by company supervisors, strikebreakers, and Chinese immigrants were plundered and torched. Some supervisors had to walk for miles through the dark woods to escape the miners' fury. It was a wild night. Meanwhile, there were the women. They had played a large role from day one. Through the union's women's auxiliary, they organized strategy meetings, raised funds, and engaged wholeheartedly in the fight. As strikebreakers and their police escorts went into work, they stood on the side and heckled them. Two women were fined $20 each for having the nerve to call the pit bosses scabs. Another time in Ladysmith, two women of Scottish descent accosted two husky but nervous young strikebreakers, grabbed their dinner pails, and smeared their faces with the jam sandwiches inside. The women were said to have shouted,
"No, you blasted ninnies, go home and see if your own mothers will ken ye."
But the best story of all involves the bold action of Minnie Axelson to get her husband out of jail. The tale is told by Lempy Guthrie, wife of local union president Sam Guthrie.
There was a little sweet fellow. He was one of the strikers. Oh, he was the most unassuming little quiet man, but I guess he thought we have to go have a drink and feel better. So I guess he had one too many, and he was feeling so happy he was going around in the street singing, "I belong to Glasgow." And then the strikebreakers, they thought that was wonderful, and they patted him on his back and said, "Go on and keep singing." Of course, when he started singing, "Hooray, hooray, we drive the scabs away," well, that just finished him, you know, so they got the police and took him to jail. And then when he was taken to jail, some of the strikers went up to the union house where the women's auxiliary had a meeting and his wife was the chairman. She was a great big Amazon woman, and somebody whispered to her that your husband's in jail. So she just said, "Well, the meeting's adjourned." So she went out the back way and she grabbed an axe and away she went up the hill to the police station. All the women followed her. So she went in then, and she said, "Mr. Connor," that's the policeman, she said, "you have my husband in jail here." And he said, "Yes, I have, Mrs. Axelson." "Well," she says, "you better let him out." "Oh no," he said, "I can't do that, because after all, he did break the law, you know, he created a disturbance." So she just showed him the axe. Well, you know, that just finished him. He got so scared, he just jumped down from his chair. "Sure, sure, Mrs. Axelson, I'll get him out. This was all a mistake, anyway." So then they let him out and she grabbed him, and it was so funny, you know, he was so tiny and she was so big, and here she grabbed him by the arm just like a little chicken with a little head, and they're marching down the street and all the women follow and the strikers all joined in, and that's how we started the riot, you see.
After their night of rioting, with the outburst out of their system, strikers resumed peaceful picketing. That wasn't good enough for the government. They ordered the militia into Nanaimo and Ladysmith. 213 strikers were arrested. One of them was Ellen Greenwell's 17-year-old brother, Willie Bowater.
My brother. They had him up for arson. They had his pal up for attempted murder. The biggest lies that God ever put breath in. My brother even saved the people's house that was against him and said that he burnt their house down. And the house was never burnt down. And do you know that they let my brother out of jail? He was in jail for 6 months and was never let out. They let him out the day before Christmas on $10,000 bail. All them years ago. And Ernie Morris, his pal that was up for attempted murder, they never did let him out. He got out when the real trials come up. And that was some trials, you can believe me. For 3 months, from January till March, we went every week to New Westminster. That's where they tried him. And then with some trials, you can believe me. I'm gonna tell you, that was a hell of a hole for men from Vancouver Island to go to. I was up in that witness box on every case from extension. And the old judge, oh, he was an old bugger. I can see him now. Big red face, he said. You know that there Miss Bowater? She's about the brazenest, brassiest thing I ever seen in my life. Anyhow, when my brother come up, they had him 4 hours in the witness box. A kid of 16. 4 hours on arson. But the jury disagreed, and he went back. But he got off the next time, just like that. At last, they got so sick and fed up with him, they threw the whole thing out. They got sick of those scabs telling lies.
Nanaimo jail, Nanaimo jail, full of good union men. They are good men, they are true men.
As the strike continued into 1914, with no end in sight, the United Mine Workers turned to another woman to bolster their spirits, none other than the famous Mother Jones. Well into her 70s, she was known far and wide for her unwavering support of working miners. She preached a fierce anti-capitalist gospel of resistance and socialism wherever she went, which was usually wherever miners were on strike. She agreed to travel north from Colorado to Vancouver Island. The thought of the white-haired firebrand in BC frightened Canadian immigration officials. They barred her from boarding the ship in Seattle that would take her to Victoria. Mother Jones, however, had friends in high places. None other than the U.S. Labor Secretary intervened on her behalf, and the next day she arrived triumphant in Victoria. Mother Jones received a rapturous welcome in Nanaimo. She described the event in her autobiography.
A regiment of Canadian kilties met the train, squeaking on their bagpipes. Down the street came a delegation of miners who wore the badge of the working class, their overalls. I held a tremendous meeting that night, and the poor boys who had come up from the subterranean holes of the earth to fight for a few hours of sunlight took courage. I brought them the sympathy of the Colorado strikers, a sympathy and understanding that reaches across borders and frontiers.
But not even Mother Jones could change the desperation of the miners' situation. The gathering war clouds in Europe hampered mobilization by the BC labor movement in support of the miners, and the union was running out of money. In July of 1914, the United Mine Workers made the painful decision to cut off strike pay. A month later, the striking miners voted to end their strike. After 23 months of heroic struggle by up to 3,700 coal miners, one of whom tragically died in prison, they voted to end their long, bitter strike. Because of company blacklists, few were hired back.
Well, that was all there was to it. The strike was lost. When the strike pay was cut off, the men started to go back to work.
Did that break the local here then?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. We got finished the local.
So did you try and get work right after the strike?
Oh, yeah. You go down there and they say, no, I don't need nobody. Well, they was full up their lots, but they had a blacklist hanging up on the wall with a paper over it.
So they weren't going to hire the miners who went out and strike?
Yeah. There were some got back, you know, but not a lot didn't get back, see?
Was the strike a total loss, do you think?
You never get a raise that will pay back your loss. But in another way, you've got to strike to keep things on a balance.
The coal miners of Vancouver Island had to wait another 20 years before they were able to organize the mines and win a union contract at last. It took even longer for the scars of their defiant two-year battle to disappear. For years afterwards, families remembered who had been on what side. Well into the 1950s, many on the union side refused to associate with those who had scabbed. There was never a strike like it, before or since.
It was way back in 1912, our gas committee was put on the shelf. First we walked out, next we were locked out, then by a fall we were all but knocked out. Our union miners faced guns and jail, hundreds of us were held without bail. By August 1914 our labor they were courting, but they blacklisted me.
Are you from Bevan? I said from Bevan. Where those fields of stumps, they beckon to me. I'm glad to see you. Tell me how be you and those friends I'm longing to see. If you're from Union Bay or Courtney or Cumberland, any place below that Bevan second dam. Are you from Bevan? I said from Bevan, 'cause I'm from Bevan.
The minor voices you heard were from Ben Horbury, Henry Gibson, and Bob McAllister. Quotes from the women of the strike were read by volunteers. Thanks to Lucy McNeil for providing the voice of Mother Jones, Bailey Garden for the voice of Ellen Greenwell, Anne-Marie Zach read the anonymous quotes, and Katie Gartland Close was the voice of Lempy Guthrie. Our thanks to Simon Trevelyan for helping to provide a copy of Bowser's 72, performed by Rika Rubsat and John Bartlett. John also sang Nanaimo Jail. Are You From Bevan was performed by Phil Thomas, accompanied by Barry Hall, vocal and guitar, and Michael Thomas, mandolin. In December 2020, the BC Labour Heritage Centre unveiled a bronze plaque to commemorate the Vancouver Island coal strike. It can be found in Dallas Square in downtown Nanaimo. Our partner in this plaque was the Nanaimo Duncan and District Labor Council, along with support from the City of Nanaimo, the Bogue Foundation, and WorkSafe BC. There have also been lesson plans developed on the strike for use in secondary school curricula. You can learn more at laborheritagecenter.ca/greatcoalstrike. Finally, thanks to the Labour Radio Podcast Network for including us among so many other amazing shows focused on working people. This is your host for On the Line, Rod Mickleborough, signing off on behalf of the podcast team, Bailey Garden and Patricia Weir. See you next time.
My name is Joanna Merwood-Salisbury, and I'm very happy to be speaking to you as part of the symposium series, Rewriting Skyscraper History. My talk is about the meaning of the skyscraper for the early American labor movement. It begins with attacks on the new building type as part of anti-capitalist rhetoric, moves on to discuss two specific groups of skyscraper laborers. These are building tradesmen involved in the construction of tall buildings and garment workers employed inside a specific kind of tall building, the loft, examples of which you can see here around the edges of Union Square. I'm going to address these groups in two specific cities in two different time periods, Chicago in the mid-1880s and New York City around 1900. It's got to be emphasized that the labor movement was far from politically homogeneous. Its members held conflicting views of the tall office building. For radicals, it was a symbol of rampant capitalism to be attacked. For the more pragmatic, it offered the possibility of change based on union organization and industrial action. In either case, the skyscraper became the site of protest, an architecture of oppression and also opportunity. My approach introduces a broader group of actors into skyscraper history. Moving beyond architects and their clients, it encompasses working class immigrants of many ethnicities, many who were characterized in this time period as racially other or racially distinct, and also a new generation of female industrial workers. These demographics have been mainly absent in the discipline of architectural history. In fact, they weren't deemed worthy of photographic record until a later period. Between the 1880s and 1910s, the industrialization of both building and manufacturing had a huge impact on working class life. This was the greatest period of labor organization in American history. As skyscrapers appeared on the skyline, groups of working people took to the streets to demand better working conditions, greater legal protections, and to express class solidarity. The two sites that I'm showing here, the Haymarket in Chicago and Union Square in New York City, are especially significant, as I'll discuss. But I'm going to start with a single building. This is a very familiar image in the history of the skyscraper, William LeBaron Jenney's home insurance building, completed in 1885. This is a crucial image in skyscraper history, where it's often presented as the origin of a type, the first steel-framed skyscraper. According to this canonical narrative, cemented in exhibitions like MoMA's Early Modern Architecture in Chicago from the early 1930s, beginning in the late 19th century, a linear and evolutionary process of technological progress led to taller and more aesthetically impressive buildings. These buildings were expressive of national power, productivity, and profit. In this sense, the American skyscraper was the pinnacle of human evolution, a technological achievement with an aesthetic based on and extending the highest cultural productions of the past. But all that's in the future. I want to tell a different story about the skyscraper in Chicago in 1885. Besides the completion of the home insurance building, which was hardly considered extraordinary at the time, what else was happening in the city in that year? On the night of April 28th, radical socialists picketed the opening of the Chicago Board of Trade. Seen here on the left, this wildly eclectic building by W.W. Boyanken was recently completed at the terminus of LaSalle Street. It was a visible symbol of the wealth that the railroads, along with the grain, lumber, and meatpacking industries, had brought to the city. The demonstration was organized by the International Working People's Association, the IWPA. Formed in Pittsburgh in 1883, the IWPA was a revolutionary workers' movement allied with international socialism and often described as anarchists. During the Depression of the 1880s, the movement grew rapidly in influence in Chicago, soon numbering over 5,000 people. For the IWPA, the Chicago Board of Trade represented not the glory and the might of Chicago, but capitalism's tyranny over the working class. The group marched from Market Square up LaSalle Street. When they couldn't gain entry to the building where an opening banquet was taking place inside, they instead marched around the building, waving banners and chanting slogans. This event was only the most high-profile example of a performative attack on a prominent business building. The IWPA published several journals, some in German and some in English. The English language Alarm was co-edited by Albert and Lucy Parsons, seen here, and it included numerous threats to capitalist institutions, including office buildings and the magnificent homes of wealthy industrialists. The Alarm also included recipes for making dynamite, so it seemed to be actively promoting the destruction of property. The Alarm's articles gained a great deal of publicity for their virulence, and they were followed up by actual bomb threats, including one at Burnham & Root's Chicago, Burlington & Quincy building, which was downtown and also recently completed. In January of 1885, a bomb was left at the main office of the railway building. Police disarmed it by dumping it into the Chicago River before it could explode and it wasn't recoverable. So quite what it was, if it was real or if it was a real threat, has never been established. However, it had its effect. Its existence was widely reported as evidence that the anarchists were about to abandon their words and take action. The IWPA also promoted a strong working class counterculture underpinned by parades and demonstrations such as the one at the Chicago Board of Trade and regular meetings, including at the Haymarket, seen here on the left, and also at the Chicago Lakefront, which was then undeveloped. The Lakefront in particular became a space of regular radical labor meetings during the summers of 1884 and 1885. Here the speakers spoke of dynamite and the use of firearms against the police and against prominent capitalists. So these meetings alarmed civic leaders and they were a great source of anxiety. The demonstrations there sometimes turned violent when anarchists clashed with the police and with private militia. Business leaders urged action and sometimes the National Guard was held in readiness. The radical rhetoric of the Lakefront meetings built on the success of recent strike action across the city, including by the building trades. At its meetings, the IWPA promoted what was known as the Chicago idea, the idea that strikes would initiate attacks on the capitalist system and ultimately lead to its destruction. During the first half of the 1880s, Chicago experienced a series of building trade strikes, which delayed the construction of almost all of the skyscrapers in the city. To cite just one example that Joseph Siri has discussed extensively, directly adjacent to the Lakefront meetings, Adler and Sullivan's auditorium was disturbed by a long drawn out labor disputes during its construction. This experience left Sullivan suffering from a nervous exhaustion when the building was finally completed in 1889. So architects and building owners perceived building trades disputes as an extension of the kind of radical rhetoric of the IWPA, but there is an important difference. Strikes were not intended to be destructive. Rather, they were attempts to realign the relationship between labor and capital to share the profits of the capitalist enterprise more widely. Although new trades were beginning to challenge the dominance of the traditional craft unions, in the construction industry in this period, bricklayers and masons were still by far the most powerful building workers. And as the work that they did grew in scale and organizational complexity, they began to leverage the power that they had in order to achieve better wages and better working conditions, and also the right to union representation, particularly collective bargaining. Bricklayers went on strike during the spring and the summer of 1883. They struck for a daily wage of $4 and a 10-hour working day. So this was a period in which the working day wasn't legally prescribed. And the strike of 1883 targeted particularly the large commercial buildings being built along LaSalle Street near the Board of Trade. That's the street you see here on the right, although this image is from a slightly later period. And it was an ultimately successful strike, mainly because the bricklayers were so indispensable to the building industry. Building work just couldn't go on without them. 2 years later, in 1885, they struck again for the first successful campaign for an 8-hour day. And so this success spurred more union organization, iron workers, electricians, steam fitters, sheet metal workers and building laborers all organized their own unions. So in the latter part of the 1880s, work on building sites was very highly prescribed by the power of unions. And the most powerful person on the site was perhaps this guy shown in this illustration called the walking delegate. This was an elected position amongst the union, the working delegate toured building sites, and he looked out for breaches of agreed upon rules, and he also wanted to make sure that there were no non-union workers being employed. And if he saw something that he didn't like, he could call a sympathetic strike, meaning that all unionized labor on that building and perhaps adjacent buildings would go on strike until conditions changed. So in this way, building sites weren't only spaces of technological innovation, they were also places where new forms of labour organisation and action were invented, experimented with, and implemented. So for obvious reasons, strikes and other forms of industrial action were strongly resisted by building developers and by architects. During the worst period of labour unrest, professional architects continued to voice criticism of striking workers and their leaders, who they called professional labour agitators, and they accused these labour leaders of importing dangerous and specifically un-American ideas from Europe. So this was a sort of deliberate conflation of the radical and pragmatic wings of the labour movement, an ideological position on the part of architects and building owners designed to weaken union power by questioning the legitimacy of the union. So the success of the building trade strikes was a sort of double-edged sword. They achieved their aims on one side, but in the other way they had unintended consequences on the way tall buildings were designed and built. Both Tom Leslie and Don Friedman have described the fact that it was the desire to undercut the power of the bricklayers and stonecutters unions that led architects to experiment with new materials and structural methods. Most significantly, what you see here in the Reliance and the Tacoma buildings, the Chicago construction, meaning a steel-framed building encased in lightweight cladding, new materials like terracotta tile. The utilization of this construction method and materials meant that far less brick had to be used, and the bricklayers' union had less power because they were less involved in the process. So there was sort of a struggle for power in the building site. Unions were at first successful. Architects and building owners developed new ways to kind of get around the power that they had, sort of a tug of war. But one event in particular sort of tipped the balance away from the unions, and that was a demonstration held at the Haymarket in 1886. This is a very famous event. A mass meeting was called in the evening at the Haymarket on the evening of May the 4th, and just as the meeting was breaking up, a bomb was detonated and several police officers were killed. This terrible event meant really the end of radical labor activism in Chicago for at least a decade. And it certainly meant an end to sympathy for the radical labor movement. The Democratic Party, which up until that period had generally supported labor and supported the right to strike, reversed its position, and any kind of labor meeting was strongly repressed. The Haymarket Memorial is the lasting monument to that particular event, and significantly it's a memorial to the police rather than to the labor movement itself.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1885. That was the day that Toynbee Hall, the first university settlement house, opened its doors to the poor and working class communities of East London. The Industrial Revolution had created a new set of social conditions, those of high unemployment and slum housing, crime and infant mortality. The vicar of St. Jude's, Canon Samuel Barnett, and his wife Henrietta hoped to combat poverty by having students settle in with the poor and working class to provide services and fight for social reforms. They named the settlement house in honor of their friend, economist and labor leader, Arnold Toynbee, who helped to organize trade unions and establish public libraries throughout East London. In its early days, Toynbee Hall championed the rights of minority immigrants, including Jews and the Irish, developed adult education and language courses, evaluated industrial working conditions, and provided free legal advice. More aligned with liberal rather than labor politics in Britain, reformers at Toynbee Hall looked to build the health of the nation by fighting for welfare reform legislation. It became a public forum for political debates and historical societies, and blazed the path for the rise of the Settlement House movement in Britain and the United States. 3 years after its opening, Jane Addams would open Chicago's famed Hull House. Other settlement houses, like the Henry Street Settlement in New York City, founded by Lillian Wald, would soon follow. Though bombed in the Nazi Blitzkrieg in 1940, Toynbee Hall continues its vision of a future free from poverty and its mission to support people and communities to break down the barriers that trap them in poverty in a bold, engaged, and open environment to this day. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner, now he's in the air and sun, but he'll stick with the union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on?
Which That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Today's music includes My Song for the Miner by Fred White, which comes from a great video by filmmaker Junie Boudreau, dedicated to Canadian miners from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, and across Canada. We've got a link, check it out, in the podcast notes. Also, Which Side Are You On? By George Mann. Find out more at George Mann, that's MANN.org. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 80 labor radio and podcast shows, something for everyone. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And see you next time.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Tell me.
Which side are you on?